The poet laureate of Arizona, Alberto Rios, captures not only the landscape of his state, but the very personal stories of people who have straddled borders. No wonder his timeless book, Capirotada, a Nogales memoir, was a one-book Arizona choice for libraries and schools across the state.
It's a very political writing, but it's a politics not of shouting and loud noises and neon, but of conversation and giving something over regarding how to understand each other. I think that's the greatest politics of all.
Alberto Rios reads from his book, The Dangerous Shirt and Capirotada, sharing how that Nogales memoir connects with New Letters magazine. Today on New Letters on the Air, produced at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam, and long before Alberto Rios was named the inaugural Poet Laureate of Arizona in 2013, he was unofficially dubbed that. Born in the border town of Nogales, he's a longtime resident and professor in Tempe, where he now directs the Creative Writing Center at Arizona State University and hosts an Arizona PBS show. The author of 11 poetry books, 3 books of fiction, and that 1999 memoir, Rios has been a longtime contributor to New Letters magazine. And back in 2009, he told me how Capirotada was inspired by his 1994 visit to Kansas City, when Robert Stewart, now New Letters editor, hosted him at Rockhurst University's Midwest Poet Series.
And as an outcome of that, we talked about my writing some things more regularly for New Letters, and it just started this column that I did for about a year, I think, and these were some of the essays that came out of it. The irony is, of course, all of this prose came out of setting up poems. When I'm reading poems, if you tell a little bit of a story about it, occasionally it gets bigger and bigger as front matter. And I think in setting up the stories for the poems I read at that reading, it was those stories that we were all trying to get a handle on. And that was the genesis of it.
And that's why so many times some of the essays echo actually some of the poems.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, that's really cool that you were able to develop it. Can we claim that we got you started
I think
in
so.
That direction?
I think so. You gave me a time frame.
Oh, that's great. Well, you know what I thought is that I would get you to read a little bit from the title essay in this book, Capirotada.
It's a fearsome title.
And it's a fearsome title and a fearsome dish.
And a fearsome dish. And it takes a lifetime to get it right. And I think that was the point I was trying to make.
Well, this particular essay is divided into 3 parts. The first part is setting up what the dish is. And the second part is a wonderful scene with your relative talking about the dish and kind of gives you a peek into what's going on. And the third part is just a little short thing. So I was going to let you decide.
You know, capirotada is a Mexican bread pudding into which you put a little bit of everything. And that's a nightmare scenario if you're a kid. You hate having food touch other food like this. So having peanuts and cheese and prunes and bread and apples and all of the things that go into it all meshed up was literally something of a nightmare. And it's not till you're an adult that you begin to see that all of these strange parts can fit together. Let me just read the very end. It's just simple. I left her at that point in the story, but I think she kept on talking. My being there or not being there had little to do with the magnificence of a recipe that's been around for centuries. That's how some things are, she said later, when I came back after eating lunch, hardly having noticed my departure. That's how they stay around, don't you think? They're trouble. Everybody knows it. They're trouble and work and worry. But I can't ever say I'm sorry when it's all done.
That was just a tiny bit from Capirotada, the title essay, and it's really much more in depth than what we just had you read.
That's the experience of making capirotada. And it's a Lenten dish, and I think people who grew up eating it have never forgotten.
It's the strangest bread pudding recipe I've ever seen. And
I'll tell you, in this one book Arizona thing, traveling all around the state and giving readings, guess what everybody made for me? I've never eaten so much capirotada tata in my life.
And from one of the essays in here, it sounds like in different places, it's got almost regional flair to
absolutely,
it.
Absolutely, absolutely.
What is it about food, which I notice comes up in a lot of your poetry as well?
It's a great question because food to me is language. And I grew up in a family that struggled with languages. In all the crossing over and all of the movement that we had, my father being from Mexico, he was born in southern Mexico in Chiapas, a little town called Tapachula. My mother was born in Warrington, Lancashire, England. They had language issues, and they resolved them wonderfully through food. And when I was growing up, my first language was essentially Spanish because I grew up around my father's family. My mother was pretty much a stranger, and even as a child, I could recognize that. So I grew up calling my mother not mama or mother or mom or anything like that, but Agnes.
You called her Agnes. That's in one of the essays.
Yeah, and what happens is in speaking Spanish, we make this big pronouncement. You're not speaking a language. You're speaking whatever it is that's going to get you fed or whatever it is that's going to get you the toy truck or anything else. And whatever words it takes, you'll learn them. And it wasn't till elementary school that the whole wave of how to help us as kids took hold in the world, at least in my part of the world, where learning English was going to be the way to go, and that was going to be the future. And by the time I reached the end of elementary school, I felt I couldn't speak Spanish anymore. I mean, kids were getting swatted around me, and there were punishments for it and encouragements for learning English. So it was about at the end of elementary school, I felt I couldn't speak Spanish anymore. And it wasn't till later in high school and college that I relearned it. But language doesn't go anywhere. It waits for you. It's more patient than you are. But during that time period, I was struggling with language myself, with Spanish specifically. I was still going to my grandmother's at least once a week. She lived near my elementary school. And my grandmother spoke no English. And I thought I spoke no Spanish. And you'd think we had a problem. But a grandmother and a grandson sitting for lunch together is not a problem. And so if language was our problem, we figured out a wonderful solution to it that I've never forgotten. And it was simple, and it's something I think everybody would recognize. She would cook, and I would eat. And that's the way we talked. And that sustained me a very long time. Even up to now, I still think about it.
Sharing food is a very powerful connection between people.
I think it is.
It truly is. And I think that's what you capture a lot.
I think the greater insight is it's the kitchen table. And it's where people gather, and food is the excuse. But the bonus is the gathering itself, I think.
Definitely. There's a poem in your newest book of poetry called The Dangerous Shirt that talks about the mystery and the magic in the kitchen. Tuesday soup. Would you like to read that?
I would be happy to. Tuesday soup. In Monday's soup, you put in what you have. Leftovers from Sunday, chicken, red rice, cilantro. On Tuesday, you put in what you have even less of now. The one leftover piece of dark chicken nobody wanted. The suspect rice with the black rim stained from something that got dropped, or from a spoon dipped into something else first, then used in the rice, a stain growing darker by the hour, darker and bigger. On Tuesday, dinner skates at the edge of the ice. Wednesday is something safe, starting over with fresh beans, a trip to the grocery store, jicama, bananas and chilies, all fresh, all new. Thursday survives by luck, living on the enthusiasms of Wednesday, the small piece of pork that was on sale, the other extras, the olives, the big sack of soft avocados, too ripe to wait, which is why they were so cheap. Friday begins the weekend, 3 days that take care of themselves in the world. But Tuesday is what people remember, like it or not. Tuesday, so easy to forget otherwise. Tuesday, always circumstance and luck. A day in which gamblers sit at the dinner table, unfortunate and miserable. but in the quiet attempt, whoever cooks dinner makes. Tuesday is the day all great discoveries are made.
Tuesday Soup. That's the opening poem to the book The Dangerous Shirt by Alberto Rios, and it's published by Copper Canyon Press in 2009. I'm Angela Elam, and this is New Letters on the Air. You know, your mother had to learn to adjust being English. By the way, is Warrington, is that a small town as well?
Yes,
in Lancashire?
It is, between Liverpool and Manchester in the industrial northwest of England.
Oh, okay. Did she sound like one of the Beatles?
She did, she did. She still retains some of that accent. And in fact, I had a little series of linguistic time bombs that went off when I was growing up. My favorite, I was a junior in high school, and I was reading a book, and I burst out laughing because I saw something that was a part of my life, and I'd never been able to recognize it. And I read the phrase in the book, bloody, and then the crucial apostrophe, E-L-L, bloody L. My mother had said that my whole life, but as a little kid, not in the context of England, the only L I had was the alphabet. So, you know, kind of gruesome, a bloody L, but my mother was kind of strange, and it sort of fit into that. And it wasn't till I was a junior in high school that I finally understood what she'd been saying all that time. Bloody L.
Oh, that's great. Well, you know, we're so able to see your parents in your memoir because you tell their stories so beautifully, how they met during World War II, and your father was stationed in England for a while, and then she left her homeland and came to Nogales, and she didn't go back for, 27 years, something like that?
Yes, and it's dramatic. I mean, it was...
It is dramatic. It's such another time period.
Mm-hmm. It's true. And those big stories, we don't have them. I think all of the kinds of media that surround us, I can't imagine. She didn't phone home for I don't know how many years. And it's hard to appreciate what those privations were and what World War II in those days meant and what it was to live through. My mother had never been more than 2 train stops from home her whole life. And to suddenly get on a boat and cross the ocean and then cross the country all by herself, because my father hadn't been discharged yet. To do that all by herself as an act of faith, my father having said just so simply that he loved her, was extraordinary, I think.
And it sounds like her family was very accepting of your father, you know, when he was there and when they were getting married, from what I read in this essay.
They loved him.
Yeah, which is really wonderful. And I think for your mom, it had to be a struggle. But it probably gave you so much insight, dealing not only with the border of America and Mexico, but this different culture, England, and watching that growing up. Do you think that contributed to you being a writer because you recognized that there was something other?
I can't tell you how much it did. It absolutely did. In fact, I think about this just all the time. My father, it's important to know physically that he was of what might be referred to in Spanish as color serio. He was very dark. He had serious color. It's a genteel way of saying something. But he was very dark, and my mother very light. But my father, when he joined the service, he was stationed first for boot camp in Texas, and he had a very, very difficult time there. And it was still in an era where there were signs that said things like no dogs or Mexicans allowed when he went off base, and he really struggled.
And that's pretty incredible.
And there was
it?
Not a week that went by in my life when my father wouldn't pull me aside. It sounds humorous now, but he would pull me aside and he'd say, son, whatever you do, don't go to Texas. And this went on my whole life. And then I leave home and I go to college and I'm writing and I get invited to give a reading in Texas, and I go and I have a great time. And I come back at a family gathering. I have to confess this to my father and I say, you know, I had a good time. And then he did something that I've never been able to forget. And I wrestle with this in my writing, and it's part of the undercurrent of what's in it. And instead of using words, he just took his finger and he tapped the skin of his face. Mm. And he said to me, it's never going to be the same for you, son.
Because we have to say you take after your mother more.
I am much. I was called güero often, which is sort of like blondie growing up. I definitely had the lighter skin. And that was a very personal and difficult and memorable lesson.
There's a little bit out of Capirotada. At Green Cards.
Yes.
This is quite a long essay, but I thought that very first part ties into what you're talking about here, and it's so deftly put. Would you mind reading that first section?
Yes, it begins with a little epigraph. All colors exist to satisfy the longing for blue. As a quick aside, I've always conceptualized the United States as being blue and Mexico as being green. It's kind of a personal feeling, but it's from my own experience. There's a folk saying in Spanish, el que quiera azul, que le cueste. One must pay for what one wants. It's a variation of the older Spanish proverb, take what you want and pay for it, says God. But the phrase means more literally, he who wants blue, let it cost him. A green card is what you get if you're a citizen of another country, but you find yourself in or cross over to the United States. The card is a first step toward applying for citizenship. My wife, who was born in Mexico, had one. My mother, who was born in England, had one. My father, born in Mexico, didn't have one, but that's another story involving some curious papers and shady explanations. My mother-in-law, after more than 40 years here, still has one. She's never been quite sure what to do next. But she's learned well that you don't raise your hand or ask the Immigration Service anything. They notice you then. Everybody knows that. They notice you, and then they do something. And they're everywhere, maybe. So you don't speak loudly. You don't ask questions. You don't make trouble. Run when you have to. Don't sign anything. Get a job only where everybody else is getting one, where it's safe. There were all kinds of stories. The one my mother-in-law lived with the longest was how her sister in Guaymas had told her they had heard that when you become a citizen of the United States, you have to spit on the flag of Mexico. And they would all shake their heads in a no, no. My mother, when she became a citizen, recalls a curious moment. After the ceremony, the high school band came into the courtroom and, because my mother was special, which is to say, in this border town with Mexico, she was not Mexican, they played for her the British national anthem. Someone thought it was a good idea. At that moment, though, she says she felt a little funny. She never forgot. None of these stories is easy, and nobody knows what will happen when you cross over, and everybody is not treated the same.
That's the very beginning of the essay Green Cards from the Nogales memoir called
Capirotada.
Capirotada. I'm talking with Alberto Rios today on New Letters on the Air, and this book was written in 1999, but it was chosen in 2009 as One Book Arizona. I think because of the great depiction not only of life in Arizona, but we also get a vision of the landscape.
If I could just go sideways from that for a moment.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
This idea of landscape is also part, I do a lot of public art, or what I call poems of public purpose. And landscape, especially water, is central to much of that. I've got a big project around a lake here in Tempe called Tempe Town Lake. And I've got all these things written on granite tiles around them, but they're all in a form called a greguería, which was something invented by a Spanish guy around turn of the century, whose name was Ramón Gómez de la Serna y Puig. They are high-style Spanish literature, but they're, in essence, one-liners, and they combine high seriousness and humor in a connective epiphany. And so these are about water. Can I just say one or two of them?
Oh, yeah.
My favorite one that he wrote, just to give you an exemplar, is a little long, but it goes like this. The old sailor on his deathbed asked for a mirror that he might look at the sea one last time. So you have this connection. You know why he's asking for the mirror. He's going to look at himself because he's been on the sea. And so there's something funny about it, but the man's about to die. So you've got all those elements there. And as I was thinking about water, here's one or two that I wrote. To visit the river quickly, cut an onion. It's a way to think about landscape and also to be connected to it. And then let's see, let me give you one more. Junior high kids are all laughing when they figure this one out. Nobody owns water. Drink some and try to keep it. So these are ways of thinking about the landscape, but also connecting to it, not just simply viewing it.
How did you come up with this idea for this project?
Oh, well, there was a big project. They were going to do this lake, and they had a call for art proposals. And the nature of public art is such that it's got to be everything for everybody, so it's immediately impossible. And we had some town meetings, and I said, you know, I'm going to have these small granite squares to put some words on. I can only write something very small, maybe a small poem. And so I said, what would be a good example of, that I could use? What kind of form could I do at all these public meetings? And everybody would raise their hands. And of course, they would say, haiku. And so I knew right away, of course, what I couldn't use. And I had taught this course in magical realism, Latin American writers, which obviously talks also about the influence of Spanish literature. And I was remembering this guy who didn't get a lot of attention, but who was writing these wonderful little sparkles. And I thought, that's it. That's what I'm going to use. And especially since I'm writing about water, how perfect.
Well, I tell you what, since we're talking about water and landscape, maybe I'll get you to read Sometimes It Rains.
Oh, sure. It's important to know, of course, that I'm writing from Arizona, where rarely does it rain. So this is big. Sometimes it rains. The ready perfumes of summer's middle days, creosote, creosote after rain, rain bringing up the last of the orange blossom smell, the droplets of water rousing the fallen leaves, enough to make a moment come back to life in them, a second once more of something, a moment from when they were white and waxy and alive with themselves. But night comes too, to gather this moment, even as we want it to stay, even as we will not go inside. The creosote, the orange blossoms, the hot honeysuckle flowers in the desert moonlight, the shadows of yucca, those sharp fronds, they make a full burst of daggers, black on the gray-colored ground of the early evening. The ochre and pink colors of this place in daytime are parts of one color at night, so that to see them, one has to breathe in. And breathing in, this has the curious effect of rain itself in that moment, the smell rousing us to what we know inside ourselves. But that is not the end of it, a rainy day turning itself into a moist evening full of crickets. This place is no different from any other place, and rain is rain here as much as anywhere. But something happens in the desert after rain has come. We sleep a good sleep that night. In the morning, we get up and find ourselves standing on the shore of the new world. In the desert, we watch, if we're careful, and when we point at everything, we are complicit in the great magician's trick of the rain. Rain falls down wet and gets up green.
Sometimes it rains. From The Dangerous Shirt, I'm talking with Alberto Rios here today on New Letters on the Air. Yeah, I think that grabs the importance of rain and also gives us a little bit of insight into your landscape. Well, let's have something a little lighter in tone. I want to skip back and have you read the title poem because I just love it. It's short and it's kind of got that whimsy.
When I was writing it, I just fell off the chair laughing. I was just having fun writing it. The Dangerous Shirt. The shirt in my closet is dangerous. I shouldn't have ironed it. Because I have, I will put it on. If I put it on, I will be dressed. If I am dressed, I will be drawn toward the door and not the couch. The door, because if I am dressed, I will not want to lie down. I will not want to get wrinkled, spoiling, after all, the hard work of ironing the shirt. If I'm dressed and standing at the door, I will want to go out, and I will go out, because what else can I do if I can't lie on the couch? So if I get near the door, that's it. Shake your head for me, because I will open it. And if I open it, I will go through it. I will go through it and close it behind me. The danger of the shirt, of course, always, every moment. It is so obvious.
That's the title poem from the book, The Dangerous Shirt. I'm talking to Alberto Rios today on New Letters on the Air. You know, that's one of the things that I appreciate about your writing, because I had several times when I was reading through your work where I laughed out loud. And it's nice that you see the import of things, but that you also recognize the humor in life, too. Mm-hmm.
I couldn't get through this stuff otherwise, I don't think. And we tend to think humor is not serious, but I try to do quite the opposite. I think it's an integral part of the higher seriousness that I approach these things with. It's okay to laugh.
It is. It's a wonderful thing. Well, you know, I thought there's a poem in your book towards the end that could be a fun ending with family.
Sure, sure. With family. I've had a family and been part of a family. I've had a child and been a child. I've loved my mother and my father, my son and my daughter, my wife and my husband. I'm not the only one. There are others complicit in this scheme. We have moved inexplicably through the years toward and away from each other. Perhaps it was the moon. But here we are now, a room full of strangers, we say. We introduce each other to each other. What happens next happens every time. We talk, and then we are caught by some shiny thing like fish, but for us the hook is a curious name, a phrase, the smells of coffee and orange blossoms, the names of all the animals we've had, something about where you were born and where I was born. The next part surprises us every time. I am in your family tree and you are in mine. If we can't find the connection going back 100 years, we will find it going back 1,000. Through all those years, I have gone by many names, tried on different clothes, painted myself different colors. How lucky to have found each other again today. How lucky, and how many stories we bring to tell. So many of them happy, though some are not and will be news. Hello, I say to you, again, after all these centuries.
Alberto Rios, now Arizona's first poet laureate, was recorded at K-Jazz in Phoenix in 2009. His poem, With Family, was published that year in his book, The Dangerous Shirt, by Copper Canyon Press, which has since released his 2015 poetry book, A Small Story About the Sky. He also read from Capirotada, a Nogales memoir, winner of the Latino Literary Hall of Fame Award. The recent poetry judge for New Letters Literary Awards, his choice appears in the Spring 2019 magazine. For links, visit newletters.org. Keep up with our State Poets Laureate series by subscribing to our free podcast or following us on Facebook, Tumblr, Twitter, and Instagram. To make a donation to endow our programs, click the Support New Letters button in the top right corner of newletters.org. A production of New Letters Magazine at UMKC, partial funding comes from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. Today's show was originally produced with Max Mosley and Dennis Conroe and updated with Anna Stokes and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.